Today's program has been brought to you by White Oak Pastures, a five-generation Georgia-based beef and poultry farm determined to conduct business in an honorable manner. For more information, visit whiteoakpastures.com. You're listening to Heritage Radio Network, broadcasting live from Bushwick, Brooklyn. If you like this program, visit heritageradionetwork.org for thousands more.
Episode 97 of The Morning After, back in the polar vortex. I am Jesse Kiefer.
I'm Sari Kamen.
Sari took over for me solo. Well, not solo. You had a fantastic co-host last week.
Yeah, I had my friend Amanda Cargill.
And
we missed you, though.
I missed you, too, yeah. Although I was very warm. I will say that I was in the sunshiny state of Arizona.
I would say I am happy for you.
Well, I will say that you were in San Diego the week before. So.
I will say you might be right.
There's a lot of saying going on. And what I will definitely say, and I'm sure that Sari will agree with me, is that the sunshine just doesn't stay with you when you come back here.
It's just not the same.
It's not the same. I really tried to bring it back.
It doesn't penetrate in the same way.
I don't think it's penetrated the sky in ages. All right.
Moving on.
So,
this is a family show.
This is a family show. I want to thank you, and it was a rad show, and will also be leaving you for another 2 weeks. I'm a jet setter these couple months.
Yeah, you're just playing with my emotions.
While I kind of slightly wish one of the weeks I'm going away was to a tropical island so I could try to get some more of that sun, I am going to France for the first time.
This time I'm not as happy for you. Because you're not bringing me.
No, I will try to bring back as much French culture as possible. I will
in
not,
the form of your accent.
I will. Yeah, exactly. That's exactly how I speak
back,
French.
Are you going to bring me back a beret and a baguette?
I hope to God. I really hope the stereotypes are true. I really do. So yeah, we're going to this incredible natural wine tasting called Le Dive Boutel in the Loire Valley. And it's not strictly Loire Valley natural wine. It is wine from all over the world. And I hear that there's a huge Georgian wine focus this year. So super excited to check that stuff out. And then for the first time in 6 years, or maybe the second time, Aaron and I will be having a solo vacation with just the two of us in Paris. Oh,
that's amazing.
Which is way overdue.
And I will say that I recently learned on Facebook that you just celebrated an anniversary years.
Of 6 years, yeah.
So mazel to you and Aaron.
Yeah, Facebook. It outs me all the time. No, it was great. We went to Romans.
Love Romans.
And in Fort Greene area, mm-hmm. which is part of the diner Marlowe and Sons crowd. Possibly my favorite of
it
all
is
of them.
So good.
I think it is because I'm partial to pasta, mm-hmm. and they do have a slight Italian kind of slant.
Oh, definitely.
And as we were kind of scooting into our little seat, somebody next to me kind of like tugged on my shirt and was like, "Hey, hope you enjoy your dinner." And it was Joe Campanelli.
No way.
Yeah. So we ended up sitting next to him and talking a little bit.
Host
and
of In the like, Drink at heritageradionetwork.org.
Shout out.
Hi.
But it was really good to see him, and I met his girlfriend for the first time. And,
oh, she's lovely as well.
We did our best to not talk and, interrupt the romantic evening that was having. But
yeah.
You know what today is?
Sunday.
It is Sunday. And all of my Australian friends, my, like, four Australian friends, are very, very excited because it's Australia Day.
No way.
Australia Day. It's Down Under Day. And they're all like, "What are you doing for Australia Day?" And I, specifically at the bar.
It's funny how your Australian friends sound like California surfers.
They're like, "What are you doing for Australia Day?"
Mate.
No. I love you, Australian friends. Mostly I just have New Zealand friends, and so it's totally not related.
Oh, those are Kiwis. Those don't count.
But it's just a smaller island off
can
the coast.
Can I say Kiwis
of
on radio?
Australia. Of course you can. So they're like, "What are you doing for Australia Day?" I'm like, "Nothing."
Going to host my show. And giving Australia Day a shout out.
Maybe I'll drink some Australian Riesling.
Oh,
right?
Okay.
I always like me a lager.
I would
so
say maybe
I'll find
some Shiraz.
Some Shiraz. Yeah.
Yeah. Mm. Yolanda.
Riesling? So I don't know. Have you ever celebrated Australia Day? Sorry.
Not intentionally, but I probably have many times. I have an aunt who's Australian, or an auntie. And she lived in the States for a little bit, and I remember always going to her house, and she would have that Marmite stuff around.
What is that? Is somebody Google chatting?
Yeah, I don't know what's going on.
Joe, are you Google chatting? Who are you speaking to?
I forgot. I have the volume up on both computers. I'm ruining your show. It's my girlfriend. She says hi.
Hi.
Is she Australian? What does she have to say about Australia Day?
Has she ever had Marmite?
I'll have to ask her. I'll leave the chat open. No, I won't. Sorry. I'm gonna end this right now.
Okay, you're fired.
It's okay, Joe. I love
anyway,
you. King of Engineers. I love you.
What I wanted to say about Marmite is that, you know, as a kid, it was like this black kind of tar-like substance it's very salty, and it was really an overwhelming flavor, not really like anything I'd had before. But I think nowadays it's something that would be more compared to miso, or, you know, it's that very,
it's
like
some umami.
It's umami, and everyone is like trying to get that umami. So I think if it was introduced in a more substantial way into our cuisine, it would probably be really well received. I bet I would like it.
Well, also, speaking of something that I think should be very well received into our cuisine, as I said, I was, you know, in the airport, obviously going to Arizona from New York. Mm-hmm. Aaron and I missed our flight, so we had to spend some time at JFK, and
I would love to vacation there sometime.
$14 Bloody Marys at, I can't remember the place it's called. I think it was called Cascata. Ooh. Is where we ended up in the American Airlines terminal, and I found a perfect what's on the menu at Chardonnay's. Ooh, what's on the menu at Chardonnay's? Never get over that. But it was just, it was so true blue Chardonnays. The dish is their specialty, Cascata specialty mashed meatball burger with melted cheddar, lettuce, tomato, pickle, onion. Can't forget any of those. It's a burger, for God's sakes.
Yeah.
Served with a side of tater tots.
Well, you had me at tater tots.
I mean, of course.
I mean, you had me at mashed...
mashed.
Meatball.
You had me at... Can we have one more what's on the menu at Chardonnay's, Joe? He hates us. What's on the menu
at Chardonnay's? Do a little backup there.
We do have a guest in studio today. Super excited about this gentleman. His name is Evan Lewandowski, and he is a winemaker for Ruth Lewandowski Wines in Salt Lake City, Utah. Yes, you heard it correct. Salt Lake City, Utah. Evan, thanks for being on The Morning After.
Thank you so much for having me. It's great to be here.
Really excited to get talking to you about how you make your wine, the process of it, and the liquor laws of Utah.
Yeah.
So we'll chat with you a little bit later in the show.
Good.
And Sari actually got up bright and early to interview a chef from New Orleans.
Yeah, I did. Chef Justin Duvalier, he was recently on Top Chef, the current Top Chef season that's still going, the one that's based in New Orleans. He's also the chef of a restaurant in New Orleans on Magazine Street. It's called Le Petit Grocery. So he's chef and co-owner with his wife of that. So we're going to hear the segment of the interview that I did with him, the pre-record. I think we're going to take a quick break.
Yeah, let's take a break.
And we're going to come back and we're going to hear from Justin Duvalier.
You are listening to Maurice Narcisse by Eula on the heritageradionetwork.org.
White Oak Pastures is the only farm in the United States that has its own USDA-inspected red meat abattoir or slaughterhouse and its own USDA-inspected poultry abattoir or slaughterhouse. We partner with Whole Foods to deliver our high-quality meat and poultry from Miami, Florida, all the way to Princeton, New Jersey. One family, one farm, five generations, 145 years. A full circle return to sustainable land stewardship and humane animal stockmanship. For more information, please visit our website, whiteoakpastures.com.
And we're back. You're listening to The Morning After on heritageradionetwork.org. I'm your host, Sari Kamen, with the lovely Jesse Kiefer.
Hello.
Hello. So we're in the back of Roberta's, and we were just talking about how I had a little visit this weekend from Justin DeVilliers. He was he is a chef, but he was also a contestant on Top Chef, the one on the season that's currently taking place. It's almost over.
Which is in New Orleans, right?
Which is in New Orleans. And he also has a restaurant that he's the chef and co-owner of in New Orleans. It's called Le Petit Grocery. So you might remember him as the guy with the beard and the hometown advantage. So Justin was here in studio, and I spoke with him bright and early the other morning. And I'd like to play that recording for you so you can hear what we talked about.
And we're back. You're listening to The Morning After. This is your co-host, Sari Kamen, and I'm here with Chef Justin DeVilliers. Hey, Justin.
Hey.
How are you today?
I'm doing great.
Thank you for coming all the way from New Orleans to see us in sub-freezing New York.
Yeah, of course. It's nice, kind of.
It's not nice. This morning was challenging. So you're the host. I'm sorry. You're the chef at Le Petit Grocery. And you're a recent contestant from Top Chef New Orleans. So I think I want to hear about your restaurant. I'm really, really interested in the food. I know you're born in California. You've been in New Orleans for a really long time. Tell us about the concept of the menu there.
I think first and foremost, it's kind of, it started as a neighborhood restaurant. And, you know, I think we maintain that still now, of course. We've kind of broadened our reach a little bit, but you know, we kind of live in a little bubble right there on Magazine Street, and we have a garden at the church across the street, and you know, kind of right in the heart of the uptown neighborhood. So we just try to, you know, kind of, I guess the cooking philosophy would be kind of just that little hyper region we live in and just what inspires us around the neighborhood.
So more local than anything else.
Yeah, at least the thought process. I mean, we definitely bring a lot of local stuff in, and we make big efforts to do that. But we also like to bring stuff in that is from, you know, different parts of the country, and as long as it's really good product, we like to use it.
How much of it is influenced by just traditional New Orleans cuisine?
I think the thought process is very much right in line with how New Orleans is always cooked, kind of, you know, we've always kind of cooked our own way down there, and it, you know, yeah. A lot of people call it Creole or whatnot, and I think it's always kind of been, though, just a mix of everyone who has, you know, come to the city at one point or another.
Yeah, I mean, New Orleans is really interesting. It's the only place that I've been in the United States that really has its own unique cuisine, kind of like, you know, when you go to Europe and you're in Paris, you're really eating Parisian food, or, you know, in Tuscany, that's, you're eating Tuscan food. New Orleans is much, is similar in that philosophy, that it kind of has its own way. But it seems like you also take a little bit of, you know, leeway, or you've let your influence from living in California or just, you know, traveling in other places be a part of that concept.
Yeah, definitely. You know, we definitely have a lot of influence of, you know, the kind of the rest of the southern region. You know, although New Orleans definitely isn't, it's like a southern, it's a city in the south, but it's not really a southern city. You know, it's kind of its own thing. Definitely, you know, some influences from my growing up in California, from, like you said, travels and stuff like that. But really, you know, the seasons and, you know, the neighborhood, and of course, everyone that works in the kitchen, that's kind of where the inspiration comes from. Mm-hmm. You know?
Yeah. So you started there kind of right before Katrina, is that right?
Yeah, I started as a line cook in 2004.
Okay, yeah, so you really were. So can you talk about what happened with Katrina and what happened with the restaurant and your involvement with that?
Yeah, so I actually had left Le Petit Grocery in May of 2005, and I went to work at a different restaurant. And then the whole Katrina thing happened in August, and when I got back, I kind of talked to the chef at the time at Le Petit Grocery, and he didn't have a lot of staff because, you know, it was hard for a lot of people to make it back to town. And
did you leave at all?
Yeah, I left for like 2 weeks. It kind of seemed like everyone had to.
Yeah.
You know, they kind of made, if you didn't leave, I think the people that didn't leave caught some flack from the government and stuff like that. And people were getting kicked out of their houses. It got, you know, everyone saw how ugly all that stuff got, but We left for like 2 weeks and came back. The city was still kind of, you know, very much in disarray, and there was National Guard and all that. My apartment got completely flooded. My girlfriend at the time, who now is my wife, her house got completely flooded. So we didn't really have anywhere to go. And we wound up staying in this hotel in the French Quarter where the restaurant that I worked at was. And it was a historic property, so they had generators that FEMA had brought in to kind of help this historic property not, you know, not get all moldy and stuff. So we stayed there and cooked on the sidewalk, you know, burgers and stuff like that. But then, you know, as the city started to get electricity back and get all the services back and stuff like that, places started opening. And Lopti Grocery, like I was saying, the staff didn't really come back, still trying to make it back to the city. So I helped him reopen then, and then kind of just have been there since.
How bad a shape was the restaurant in?
Not bad. I mean, everything was intact. It didn't flood or anything like that. Oh. Just, you know, a cleanup project and kind of, you know, I think the biggest struggles for us at that time was just logistics of deliveries and services and, you know, because a lot goes into a restaurant, obviously. I mean, all the way down to, like, you know, the daily trash service and stuff. After Katrina, all that stuff was very hit or miss or very spotty, so.
Yeah. And then how did you end up becoming the executive chef?
So in 2007, the opening chef decided to go embark on his own project not far from La Petite, and I kind of got thrown into it. I wasn't hesitant, but I felt like there's still a lot of things I wanted to kind of do before I, you know, planted my feet and took a job like that. But, you know, I kind of went with my gut and took the job, and it's been great. I love it.
Yeah. Did it, I mean, were you emotionally prepared for it, or you just kind of,
I mean, I think, yeah,
went for it?
I think, I mean, I think, you know, I didn't know what the hell I was doing. But
yeah, because like you're self-trained, right?
Yeah, and I was 26 years old at the time so I'd been cooking for about 6 years. And but it's one of those things, you know, it's like, if I wouldn't have done it, I would have always wondered, you know, yeah, at least for a while, like, well, you know, I wonder what, you know, what that would have been like. But
yeah.
So, yeah, here I am now in 2009. Some of the original partners decided they wanted to sell their shares of the restaurant. So we bought those too, so now we're majority partners and majority owners of the restaurant.
Mm-hmm. And what is the restaurant like now that you're the chef compared to what it was like when you first came on, in terms of, you know, the menu and the concepts?
It's quite different. I mean, I think when I used to work there before, you know, before I was the chef, it was a little bit more grounded in traditional New Orleans-y kind of food, like kind of New Orleans bistro-ish kind of food. A lot of stuff that you'd see at, you know, in the 90s and early 2000s at places like Bistro Maison de Ville or Peristyle, or, you know, these restaurants that kind of, they were a big influence in the 90s on New Orleans food, but I kind of felt like the food was a lot more like that.
Mm-hmm.
The windows were closed with curtains, so it was very intimate and kind of private in there. And we took the curtains down. We, you know, opened the place up a lot, changed a lot of the lighting and a lot of the chairs and tables, and the menus very much more. It changes every day, pretty much. So
yeah.
We have a small menu of six items that changes every single day. And then we have a large menu that changes about every 6 weeks.
Yeah. And you're cooking kind of, from what I saw on Top Chef, you have a really delicate touch. And I think that could separate you from, you know, maybe other chefs in New Orleans, which the food tends to be, you know, very heavy, very seasoned. You have a nice finesse about your food that,
you know, I really like to kind of keep, like, stay minimal with ingredients.
Mm-hmm.
I love rich food, especially when it comes to like meat sauces and long braises and stuff like that. But that being said, I feel like that those can be pretty simple too.
Yeah.
But yeah, definitely I like three ingredient type things and very minimal.
Yeah. Great. So I think it's inevitable that we talk a little bit about the show.
That's fine.
Okay with you. So what was the experience like? I mean, you were in your hometown, and you know, there was a lot of talk about you having a hometown advantage. How did it feel to be on that cooking show? And a lot of the times you went to events or to different restaurants where you had to compete, and you were serving your peers.
Yeah, it was funny because I did get to see a lot of people. You know, I recognized people around town and stuff like that, and you know, couldn't really talk to them while we're shooting. But
did it give you an extra sense of support to be around people that you know, or was it more intimidating because of it?
I don't think either way. I mean, it's pretty, like, the competitions are so intense that, like, the challenges are so intense that, yeah, I didn't really think about, you know, too much about that.
You're just in it.
Yeah, yeah, it's pretty, I mean, it's like, it kind of, if I was to explain it, if I was going to describe it, I'd say it's kind of like that, like, last hour before service,
mm-hmm.
but for, like, 6 hours.
That sounds awful.
Yeah,
having been a server, that sounds so awful.
No, it was a lot of fun. A lot of fun.
I mean, the show should be called, like, Survivor, really. Like, Cooking Survivor. I mean, this season, I don't know, I haven't seen all the seasons, but, man, they work you guys to the bone. It's like, no sleep till Brooklyn over there.
Yeah, it's
Is it really as extreme as it seems?
I mean, I can only speak for myself, but it's a lot of fun. It's a lot of work, but I think that's, you know, that's part of the fun of the competition, I think.
Yeah.
You know, it's not like, you know, you're never hurting or anything. It's just working your ass off, so.
Yeah. And then, okay, so it's still going on, yeah, the show. Mm-hmm. Although it's probably actually over, but it's not really live, is it?
I don't know.
You don't know? I don't know if I believe you. okay. Did you do the Top Chef kitchen afterwards?
Yeah, Last Chance Kitchen.
Yeah.
Yeah, it was funny because their whole thing was they wanted to take the home field advantage away.
Uh-huh.
So they had the other guy who I was battling against, and they gave him New Orleans cuisine to cook, and then they gave me, he was from California, so they gave me California cuisine. So I was like, wait, you're taking the home field advantage away, but you're giving me, like, my other...
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. You're like, I'll take it. Yeah.
So, but he still whipped me, so I guess it didn't matter.
Yeah. So what's life been like post the show?
I mean, I don't know.
Besides, you know, you're doing interviews at radio stations.
Yeah. It's been the same. I mean, you know, I will say it was, you know, getting back to normal routine was interesting, but you know, after that it's the same.
Yeah.
The dishes still pile up.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah. Do you feel like you're getting more people coming into the restaurant, or there's a bit of celebrity attached to it since you were in your hometown?
Yeah. I mean, everyone's really, really cool about it. You know, a lot of I get a lot of kid fans, which is cool.
Oh, nice. 'Cause
I never really had a big clientele of, you know, young people, but it's pretty cool. You get, like, you know, 13, 14-year-olds that watch the show, and they come in and eat. It's kind of neat.
And they're eating your food?
Yeah, and they're all pumped on it, you know?
Oh, that's like, really,
yeah,
cool.
Yeah, so. But everyone, yeah, I mean, the community in New Orleans has been great, you know?
Yeah.
Everyone always says something, but it's always nice.
Yeah. That's a little bit funny and ironic, because, you know, I just watched the episode that you went down for, the college one.
Yeah.
And that you were... I mean, it was a good episode to go down for. Like, you had a really legitimate excuse. You're like, I never went to college. I don't know what they eat.
Yeah.
You gave college kids the benefit of the doubt that they would like more sophisticated food.
Yeah. You know, I don't even know if it was so much sophisticated. It's hard to cook out of a cafeteria. I learned that much.
I can't even imagine in cooking for that many people.
Yeah. And, you know, cafeterias have some interesting ingredients in them. But it was fun. I mean... You know, I always, it's funny because I think about it, about that day a lot.
Sure.
Like, you know, things I would have easily, like, hindsight's totally 20/20 on that one. Like, oh, I would have done this, I would have done that. But at the end of the day, that's, you know, that's what it is. That's why it's fun. It's because it's kind of a mind game as well as a, you know, physical cooking thing.
Yeah, I'm always so impressed with how well people handle being sent home. Or at least that's the way that they show it on TV. You know, there's so much dignity there and pride and just humility, I guess.
Yeah, I mean, there's nothing you can really do about it, right?
Exactly, and but it's hard to be on camera, I'm sure, you know, just being that exposed when you're having to face just something that you don't like.
Yeah.
Yeah. You guys did a good job.
Yeah, those are pretty brutal. The judging tables are pretty brutal.
Yeah.
Yeah, but...
It looks that way.
But I mean, it's good. I mean, I think it's good to learn. You know,
have you been watching the episodes?
I watched all the ones that I was on, and then I watched. I think I've watched a couple since. But
is there anything that you saw in terms of like editing or the way you felt you were portrayed that you didn't think was necessarily accurate or was manipulated?
No,
that's good.
I went in there with the kind of mindset of, you know, if I just totally be myself, regardless of, you know, what that is, if I just completely be myself, then at least I'll be comfortable with it.
Yeah.
You know?
Cool. All right. It was really nice to have you. Unfortunately, we do have to wrap up here, but cool. What are you on a tour right now, or are you heading back to New Orleans?
No, we did a dinner last night at, for the New Orleans Preservation Resource Center.
Oh, great.
And it was a fundraiser in the city, so
yeah.
I was up for that, and then I'll be heading home.
Okay, well, that's good. I'm sure you've missed home for a while.
Yeah.
Yeah. All right, well, I want to thank you, Chef Justin.
Cool, thank you.
Yeah, it was really nice to meet you, and you're listening to The Morning After on heritageradionetwork.org.
You are listening to Oh Lord by Eula on the heritageradionetwork.org. Check out Eula on February 1st at Death by Audio, 8 p.m. Like what you hear so far? Support the network and become a member. Membership helps us bring you the best food radio in the world and gives you access to thousands of dollars in discounts at the sustainably minded businesses that support us. To become a member, visit heritageradionetwork.org today.
Dom, 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 dom.
This is The Morning After on Heritage Radio Network. That is, I think, going to be my intro to any wine person, sommelier, pretending wine person, whatever you want to call them, from here on out. This person is not a pretender. Evan Lewandowski of Ruth Lewandowski Wines is in studio today. He has trekked all the way from Salt Lake City, Utah, where he has a winery, and he also manages a beverage program. Welcome to the show, Evan.
Thank you.
Bom, 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 bom.
Som.
So I guess I just want to, right out the gate, say Salt Lake City is not synonymous with winemaking.
No, it's not.
Let me know, I guess, why you are making
that
wine there.
Get out of the room.
Yeah. Whoa, I feel... a lot lighter.
Me too.
Yeah, seriously. So
and it's not the Lambrusco we're drinking.
No. In the end, Salt Lake is not. It's not the nexus of the winemaking universe. Not all wine roads meet in Salt Lake City.
No,
they really don't. Not at the Temple Square. But in the end, it's a super long, convoluted story how it got me there. But as far as climate is concerned, the soil profile there. It's amazing. It really, really is amazing. I fell in love with it for other reasons than wine straight away, but came to wine along the way via interesting channels a la Zev Ravine, one of my best buddies, now my distributor here in New York. Mm-hmm. And this is where I'm at. I decided that this is what I wanted to do, and I wanted to figure out if Utah was a viable place for growing world-class wines. So
are you from Utah?
I am not, but I got there just as quick as I could. My father was in the Air Force. I was lucky enough to bounce around every 2 years with him, and after graduating high school, I was looking for a place to ski, and the University of Colorado at Boulder was far too expensive, and my father had heard that it was a crazy party school, and so he was like, yeah, you know what, you're not going to go there. You need to figure something else out. So talking to my guidance counselor, They actually do good things in high school. Yeah, the guidance counselors, literally, this
is... I can't remember that far back. No, I don't either.
You needed a guidance counselor, apparently.
Yes.
To guide you. So my guidance counselor guided me towards the University of Utah. She said, you know, well, what about the Olympics? Those are happening next year. They've built new dorms, blah, blah, blah. They have skiing there. They're having the Winter Olympics. So I checked it out on the internet. And sure enough, the homepage said 11 ski resorts within 45 minutes. That's the only school I applied to. My father and I went out for a campus visit in late March, my senior year. And we pulled up to the admissions office. And it's just dumping, just puking snow. And he looks over from the passenger, from the driver's seat. And he looks at me and he's like, "You're going here, right?" And I'm like, just smile, like giddy, like, "Aww, yeah, I'm totally going here." And he goes, "So we don't need to do this, do we? This admissions tour, this like check out the campus." And I'm like, "Nope.
Yeah, let's go skiing."
So we went skiing straight away. And I've skied at that resort since that day. That's my home resort, Brighton. Ski Brighton or brightonresort.com. Go there. It's awesome. It's the best ever. So I went there for skiing in the end, fell in love with the place, was working at a couple different little high-end restaurants as a busboy, and then moved up to server, was required to go to wine trainings, and was blown away by quality wine. The very first wines that I had at the wine training changed my life. To be able to say that 2001 Robert Mondavi Fumé Blanc changed your life is a big call, and it changed my freaking life. So I just kind of set off from there. Went back. I graduated from University of Utah with a degree in physiology and French, and then went back to school. Or I did an internship. Actually, I was working at a wine bar with Zev Ravine. It was his first business venture in Park City, Utah. He hired me on as a 21-year-old. I was certain that I needed to be in wine. I didn't know what that meant. But Zev had the coolest spot, so I went there. He hired me on, and through those connections, some dude walks in the bar. Zev pulls me over and is like, "You need to talk to this guy. You say you want to grow wine or make wine or do something, and you don't know how to get into it. Talk to this guy right now." And he happened to be one of the upper-ups in an organization called Communicating for Agriculture, which places, or CAEP, they place interns, apprentices from all over the world in American wineries.
Okay.
And this was the first year that they were accepting American applications to work in American wineries. I applied that day. He waived the application fee, so it was super easy for me. Applied that day, and I got my first apprenticeship that year. For a harvest gig, and for whatever reason, I didn't kill myself, and I continued on. I went back to school for viticulture, got a degree studied viticulture in Washington State, and I've just done apprenticeships all over the world trying to figure out how Utah was going to work, what varieties I needed to grow, or places that had similar soils, or places that similar altitudes, because altitude's a big deal there. Mm-hmm. As far as the vine habit. So that's the long drawn out story of how Utah happened and what my goal is there.
Well, Utah. So at this moment, you've put out your first vintage, which is 2012. Mm-hmm. You are not currently growing grapes in Utah yet.
I'm not.
You have sourced fruit from Fox Hill Vineyard in Mendocino.
Mendo.
Which is cool climate, California.
In the end, it can be. Mendocino is fairly large as far as a county is concerned. You've got Anderson Valley and then mm-hmm. and then Mendocino Coast, Mendocino Ridges. But where this fruit comes from is actually sort of 101 corridor just north, or it's about halfway in between Ukiah and Hopland on Old River Road, just up from the Fetzer facility, the big guys there. It's about 2 miles north of that. It's on Talmadge Bench. It's actually really stinking hot.
Oh, yeah?
Yeah. It's very, very warm there, but in a good way. But all the stuff that I source from Fox Hill is it's this extremely cool place. A gentleman named Lowell Stone planted it about 25 years ago. And basically, his goal, he was so enamored with Italian varieties that he got whatever he could at the time in California. So he's got this little, like, 1985 library of every single vine stock he could get from UC Davis or from whatever nursery he could get or he could find. And you know, he's got a bunch of different clones of Primitivo, Barbera, Dolcetto, Nebbiolo, Aglianico, Nero d'Avola, just crazy stuff. Mm-hmm. Lots of really, really interesting
things.
You
would not imagine it's growing in California.
No, but then thinking about it, looking at the soil profile there, uplifted sandstone, really, really pebbly, well-drained, bereft of all nutrients, it's extremely cool. It's very, very appropriate for what he's doing. And he was very, very smart about the whites that he planted. He planted Arnaiz, Cortese, and Tokaj Friulano. But the Arnaiz and the Cortese, he planted in this little clo, this little enclosure, right butted up against Bureau of Land Management land. Didn't put a freaking deer fence around it, though, which is super annoying.
Do they like...
The deer loves Arnaiz.
Which they like the Arnaiz. Deer it's loves, a little bit more floral and aromatic.
Right? Succulent and spicy. Yeah, so the deer love the Arnaiz and the bears love the Cortese. oddly enough, if you look at the labels, I was not necessarily a critter label person. I kind of hated critter labels, but I couldn't help but put dead deer and dead bears on my labels. So...
So no, they are really beautiful labels, and the labels do have a story. So I guess I want to get into your process of wine, and then we'll talk about the label story.
Sure.
So I think that for someone who works in wine, I very much understand what you're doing, but I think not everyone out there understands that not every person who makes wine also grows their own grapes. Not every person who makes wine owns a vineyard. So you're purchasing fruit with the eventual idea that you will grow grapes in Utah.
Exactly.
But at the moment, you're purchasing fruit in California. So you love the Fox Hill Vineyard. You've found the right varieties for you. What do you do next?
I don't know. Help.
I just mean as in like the process of making the wine.
Yeah.
From there.
So Fox Hill Vineyard, that's one source for fruit, Little Stone, and then the Testa Vineyard in just north of Ukiah, made famous by Tony Couture. He made Testa Vineyard carrying on for years and years, and kind of put that on the map. I'm extremely lucky to be there at all. Even to walk those vines is just extremely special for me because they're perfect. Perfect. The Martinson family, Maria Testa and her husband Rusty, are potentially some of the best American farmers I think out there right now. But humble, they would never know mm-hmm. it. Which is another very endearing thing. And then the Gibson Ranch is where I get the Grenache Gris, made famous by Randall Graham, Jared and Tracy Brandt from Knocking Goat, Two Shepherds. Those guys are pulling fruit from there. Sam at Idlewild Wines. Making some extremely cool things from there. All that being said, those are extremely cool places. Those mm-hmm. are extremely cool vines, really, really well cared for, that speak very, very clearly through the wines. But the dream is always Utah.
Mm-hmm.
So planting there is of utmost importance to me. I can't freaking wait to do it. Mm-hmm. That's where my passion lies. I love making wine. I love these vineyards, like I said. But I am just frothing to plant vineyards and to make booze out of Utah grown fruit from these crazy soil profiles in the Utah area. It's in the end it's a beautiful, delicious means to an end. Planting is an extremely long, drawn out process. Mm-hmm. If I order vines in April or May for this little parcel I'm looking at in southern Utah, I order those in April or May, and the varieties that I'm looking for on their own rootstock that aren't grafted, there's not just nurseries full of Kerner and Gruner and Riesling.
So you're
on
thinking
their own
like a kind of northern Italian,
exactly.
Austrian
yep.
kind of thing.
Okay. So my time in Alto Adige really, really taught me a lot of things about Kerner and Riesling and their relationship to each other and how they grow. Riesling's my passion. That's what I want to do in the end. But Riesling is a very long growing season white variety. In fact, you go to Alto Adige or you go to Alsace, and that's the last thing they pick.
Mm-hmm.
even if it's not in a dessert style. Finger Lakes, yeah, it's super long. It's a long growing season white variety, but very hardy in the winter. It's got really hard wood. Sorry, I got a little bit distracted when I said that. Super weird. It's got extremely hard wood. It's very, like I said, it's very cold hardy. It's cold hardy. That's
family where I'm show. Going with it.
Yeah.
Family show.
Family show. Family
no.
show. So cold, yeah. So cold hardy, but again, it's tough. Those bookends in Utah can be very, very, very crazy. You never know what you're going to get in the spring or the fall. It could be sunny and 72, or it could be dumping snow and frigid.
Mm-hmm. Can I ask a question, Evan? I'm just curious about those grapes that you're so interested in. Is it because those are the grapes you happen to love, or do you see like a similar terroir from Alto Adige to Utah, or right. have you experimented at all?
Luckily, Riesling's what I love, but Riesling is also, I think, very, very appropriate for the soils that I'm looking at. Sandstone, limestone, shale, a little bit of schist.
Is anyone growing wine in Salt Lake City?
In Salt Lake City? No.
Okay.
I mean, there's mom and pop vineyards kind of backyards all over the shop, but in southern Utah, this is where you'll find, like south central Utah, there's a few vineyards here and there, but in southern Utah, there's maybe 60 acres total, 65 acres total. As opposed to California, which has about 750,000 acres under vine.
Yeah. But I do feel like southwestern wine is showing up.
It's there on the
is
up.
There's
yeah.
definitely, I mean, when Aaron and I were in Arizona, Arizona Stronghold was truly the best
yeah.
wine that we were buying. Like it was you know, pretty
it's legit
tried
stuff.
And true. And
yeah.
I will say that the Arizona market is hard to find, you know, things that we can find here, but I thought it was great. And then obviously Gruet in
Gruet.
New Mexico.
Yeah.
So I mean it makes
yeah.
sense. It does make sense
yep.
to me. So as far as your process, your winemaking process goes, so you to say that you have a winery in Salt Lake City, but you have this fruit in California, that means that you're pressing the juice in California and then tell me about like transporting
sure.
juice across state lines.
You could talk to
what's
my dad
that like?
About that. My dad would give you a really good idea what that's like because he's a big part of the process. So it depends on the wine. So the Arnais Malin comes back as juice, like you said. Killian is my skin fermented white that's made of 100% Cortese from the Fox Hill. That comes back as must, which is juice and skins. And then Boaz is the red from 2012, and that comes back as whole cluster fruit. So I bring things back. I make things as complicated as possible for
okay,
myself because that's how I roll. I couldn't do it any other way. And so I actually partner with a winery in California where I used to be the assistant winemaker. We're still really good friends, really good relationship. It's called Kivira. It's in Dry Creek Valley. I stage things there. I go out to California for about 8 weeks, 10 weeks, I'll pick the fruit, bring it back, press the Arnais, get that into tank, and that technically begins fermentation in California, starts bubbling, and then and then travels across Nevada in a sort of bubbly happy state, and then continues its fermentation, goes dry in Utah. The Cortese that comes to Kivira at Dry Creek, and then is destemmed there. So take it off the stems and put it into tank there, and then that goes back across Nevada straight away, and finishes its fermentation process in Utah, and stays on its skins for an extremely long amount of time. Actually, the Killian 2013 is still on its skins as we speak, just chilling in Salt Lake City. Haven't pressed that yet. And then the Boaz is picked and straight away to Salt Lake City from there, from the Testa Vineyard. Yeah, that's how that goes. And then everything ferments in Utah. The cool thing about the way that I make wine is that there's not really anything else that I do. There's no filtration. I don't have big machines. I don't even have a plate and frame filter. Not that I'm necessarily against plate and frame or against filtration. I just I haven't had the need for it, and I don't have the money, so it works out. It works out really well. Natural wine works out really, really well.
For poor people.
If you're broke. If you're broke, yeah. And I think that really speaks so highly of the farmers and mm-hmm. the people that grow it. Lowell Stone and Maria Testa. And the people behind the Gibson Ranch, it's in the end, it's the Bilbro family. They do really well. And when your fruit is in the condition that it is when it's picked and put in my bins, I'm super confident, extremely confident. In fact, it's almost terrifying because looking at it, you think, well, I can only mess it up now. It's so perfect. For Maria, I've never seen better red fruit in my life, and I've seen a lot of red fruit. It's like jaw dropping how perfect her fruit is. And so getting that, I can't help but want to do nothing to it. So it ferments whole cluster, foot trotting for a few days, then hand pigeage for a few weeks. And then I press it and then it hangs out and
fermentation starts by natural yeast.
Yep. Yep. So in the end, getting super technical, I make little pied de cuve, from the vineyards, going out to the vineyards, picking trash cans full of fruit, and then having that begin fermentation, looking at that fermentation under the microscope, making sure that those yeasts are good yeasts, Saccharomyces ovoid shaped yeast, not a lot of bacteria, and that's what I actually do inoculate all of my fermentations, and not a lot of people know that a lot of natural wines are actually inoculated, but they're inoculated with themselves. That's how a lot of guys roll.
With
the mother culture. It's that's what it's about. And you put that in, because you can pick a trash can full of fruit and cross your fingers, twiddle your thumbs and pray that little fermentation goes well. Or you can pick 3 tons and spend a lot of money on fruit and have that in a very vulnerable phase for 4, 5, 8 days. You pick the pied de cuve, look at that under the microscope. Don't be a dummy. And put that in your fruit, and then that will, and that's why everything's so clean, I feel.
Mm-hmm.
Natural wine's awesome. If it's not clean, it's not awesome. It can be kind of dirty and awesome, though.
Yeah, I totally know what you mean.
There's definitely that. But
I want to talk about, we kind of mentioned earlier about your label, but I think first, okay, your name is Evan Lewandowski. Your wines are called Ruth Lewandowski. Who's Ruth?
Ruth is not my girlfriend. Someone asked me the other day, so Ruth is your girlfriend?
Is she your grandma?
No, not my grandma, not my mom, but who names their winery after a girlfriend? It's like getting a tattoo on your, like, you're going to change that name, right? You're going to change the name eventually.
Better be your wife. It's going to be your name.
Yeah. That's your girlfriend? No, it's not my freaking girlfriend. No, Ruth is not my mom, girlfriend, or grandmother. Ruth is actually my favorite book in the Bible. Salt Lake City Wine.
With a biblical name.
Biblical name. Imagine that. Yep. So Ruth, it's in the Old Testament, and it's a very, very concise, it's not a long book, for those that have very, very short attention spans. It's also a very sexy book,
Hey, watch it. My grandmother's name was Ruth.
It's the most beautiful, strongest female character in the Bible, I think. She's an amazing, amazing person. I think that book really demonstrates, one, the entire theme of the Bible, but also my heart for natural processes that happen in the world.
I.e. death,
yeah. So that death and tragedy or the cessation of things are 100% necessary for beginnings, for life, and for things to continue on. So death, in the end, is the engine that keeps things going, that keeps things moving forward. Death absolutely has to happen. You look at the things that you eat, stuff had to die. Mm-hmm. Stuff had to die for you to put it in your face.
Mm-hmm.
And to keep you alive. Or that one thing that was so tragic in your life, that moved you forward and you learned from it and then new life came from it. It's the same with the soil. Like, there's nothing alive in the soil that wasn't fed by something that died first. So compost is a huge thing. The mm-hmm. regeneration of our extremely, extremely messed up farmland, that requires death. That requires nutrients that are brought about through the death of other organisms. So yeah, and in the end, on the label, it's basically an animal upside down. I mean, it's not a crime scene. There's not like it's not like death. It's not super graphic, but
it's not like murder to bears because they ate my cortese.
Exactly, that jerk. You know, it's an upside down animal with flowers coming out of its mouth.
It's a really beautiful label.
Thanks.
It is.
I pulled my hair out over that.
No, I think it's a shelf talker.
Totally.
It's an eye catcher for anyone who sees the label. So, I mean, I think it makes sense. And, you know, with death comes life. And it's
definitely.
So if anyone wants to sit and contemplate that thought in the Book of Ruth,
yeah,
where can we find your wines? Can you order them directly from your website?
You can. Absolutely. So my email, my cell phone, being that little guy, it's all on the website, RuthLewandowskiWines.com. Yeah, so you can place an order. I can ship directly to you, really really easily. It comes in 6-packs. It's the 2012 vintages is pretty much sold out.
Mm-hmm. Well, congratulations!
Thank you. It's crazy to think about. And in the end, that's another thing that should be mentioned. It's here in New York. It's distributed by Zev Ravine Selections, and the lovely people that work for him that do their job so stinking well. That get this wine sold. Yeah, so it's in accounts all over the city, which is flabbergasting to me to be sold here. It's extremely cool. So yeah, through Zev Ravine and his minions and his empire, his extremely small natural wine empire.
Totally.
I love it.
Well, I mean, I will come out and say that I sell the Killian by the glass.
Yeah.
So Terroir Tribeca, it's there, y'all. Well, Evan, this has been fantastic talking to you, and I hope we get to speak with you next when you've planted fruit in Utah
and you're
making wine from that.
I can't wait. Give me 10 years.
All right.
We'll be here.
All right. Well, I'm kind of signing off for a couple weeks.
Yeah.
Next week, we're going to take a Super Bowl break. Sari's going to go investigate if we can find any Velveeta out there.
Mm-hmm. I'll be reporting live from the scene on my Twitter account.
Exactly. and I will be headed off to France. So we will be back here on the 9th.
Yeah, I'll be here.
And I will be in France.
Mm. And right. We will be here and we will miss you.
Absolutely.
Okay.
This is The Morning After on heritageradionetwork.org.
Thanks for listening to this program on heritageradionetwork.org. You can find all of our archived programs on our website or as podcasts in the iTunes Store by searching Heritage Radio Network. You can like us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter at @heritage_radio. You can email us questions at any time at info@heritageradionetwork.org. Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization. To donate and become a member, visit our website today. Thanks for listening.